Day and night my thoughts incline to the blandishments of wine. Jars were made to drain, I think. Wine, I know, was made to drink. Richard Henry Stoddard. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. I'd like to thank everyone for joining me this week. To my longtime listeners, or maybe recent listeners, welcome back. I thank you guys for your patience while I took a couple of weeks off, or a couple of episodes off. I have been working on the show a little bit behind the scenes, not as much as I had hoped, but I did go on vacation. That was fun. I saw some snow, which is not something I typically get to see very often. That was fun. Hung out with some good friends of mine. And then, of course, got back from that to have a short week at work and get ready for Thanksgiving and, saw family, watched a lot of college football. My alma mater won. We were victorious. Now we just got to wait and see what happens with the conference title so we can see if we might get into the national title playoffs. Long shot, but it is possible. We are not mathematically eliminated yet. So, but with all that stuff out of the way, if you're a newcomer, welcome. I just took a couple of weeks off. I haven't done that in a little while. So we're going to be diving back into our next section. And this episode is going to be mostly focused on kind of etymology more than anything else. I was kind of debating on what areas I wanted to cover after we finished up, the kind of the Proto-Sumerian time frame and region. And I've decided I want to kind of focus on everything south of the Caucasus, kind of curving towards Central Asia. So kind of the Indo-Iranian plateau area. But I want to kind of include the Caucasus there because there's a little bit of overlap. Now, the Zagros foothills, we've kind of mentioned some peoples that are probably coming from there and moving towards Mesopotamia, but there's definitely connections between peoples in the Caucasus and peoples in the Zagros. So while you have some Zagros peoples, moving into the Mesopotamian region, you probably have some with long-range ties to the Caucasus as well, and vice versa. There are people in the Caucasus moving towards the Zagros Mountains, the Iranian Plateau, all those kind of regions. So before we kind of get into the history of that, this episode's probably going to be mostly focused on etymology of some of the geographic features that I've maybe mentioned before, but I haven't gone into huge detail on. So this one's kind of just going to be kind of a reintroduction to the region. Talk about the mountains, hills, rivers, valleys, that kind of thing. They're going to be so important to the material cultures that are beginning to, or who have been in the region and are further developing and evolving. And how they're tied into some of the places we've talked about in the last section. And of course, how they'll be interacting with places that we're going to be talking about in future sections. So, to that end, this is essentially going to include areas of the modern countries of Georgia, Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Iran, and a little bit of Turkey and Iraq, too. But most of what's going on in those two has already been covered or, will be, in the future. Again, most of this episode is going to focus on etymology. From some geographic features, some of which I've talked about before, some of which I haven't talked about really at all. I may have mentioned them, but I haven't gone into any detail. And once we kind of set the stage, I hope this information will take root, so when we return here in the future, I won't have to go over it as much. But, of course, we'll be probably focusing on these areas probably for the next two or three episodes. So I hope you look forward to that. And to start off with this, we're going to talk about the etymology of the mountains, which, of course, are vital to the lifestyles that the peoples living between 6 and 4,000 BC at the in these regions are, you know, it's vital to their way of life. So these mountains are something that are part and parcel of not only, you know, all your struggles, but also all your survival. And of course, you know, there are hills, valleys, rivers, and stuff that comes down from the mountains, but the mountains themselves are the primary features. So that's why we're going to focus on those first. Now, I should point out that all this etymology is for English speakers. Some of these names are not used, you know, outside of Europe or America. Some have local names. Some have different kind of designations in other languages, of course. But this is, of course, I am an English speaker, so that's why I'm going to be going over that. Now, I've covered the Caucasus before. You can go back. I think in Season 2 I went over the etymology of the Caucasus themselves. But in short, the name probably meant something like shining bright or shining white. And that's probably a Proto-Indo-European or Proto-Proto-Indo-European language designation. Those, of course, divide Europe from Asia, at least in my reckoning. Some people would disagree with that, but that's my opinion. Or I should point out, they're one of the things that divide Europe from Asia. There are obviously other borders, but yeah, this is one of them. After you get through the Caucasus, or before you get through the Caucasus, I guess, depending on if you're heading north or south, there is another range of mountains. There's a very vast kind of rolling grassland between the Caucasus and the second range, which are known as the Lesser Caucasus, also sometimes called the Caucasia Minor or Caucasus Minor or the Anti-Caucasus. And they share, of course, the same etymology. Though the descriptive term changes depending on your source. Anti being Greek, minor being Latin, and lesser being English by way of the Proto-Germanic, Lycesian. Both minor and less come from the Pyrupes May and Lace. Both meant small, but Lace was probably used in a more comparative sense, while May probably just meant small in general. Of course, both of those initial roots drifted differently to technically cover the other's meaning. But if I'm being honest, anti makes more sense as it can mean opposite or opposing something. And the anti-caucuses are fairly parallel to the Caucasus mountain range directly. And there is, again, that large valley between them. And lesser makes sense too, as they are technically smaller than the Caucasus. And I guess minor works that way as well, but I have a problem describing any mountain range as minor. But there you have it. So I'll probably use anti-Caucasus or lesser Caucasus in my readings, unless I'm quoting directly from a source that says otherwise. Next up, we have the Pontic Alps, or the Pontic Mountains. In Turkish, they are referred to as, and forgive me again, my Turkish listeners, Kuzey Anadolu Dağları, which translate as North Anatolian Mountains. Now, apparently, the locals speaking the regional dialect of Turkish or Greek, because there are local, you know, people speaking the local dialects for both languages still in the area, use a far older term to describe these mountains, and that term is Parhar. Now, this was the Hittite name for the mountains, or I should say, this will be the Hittite name for the mountains, because again, we are in that 4,000 to 6,000 BC range. And it probably just meant summit or height. And derivatives of this name were used by later Greek and Roman writers like Strabo and Pliny the Elder. They used Pariadres or Parahedri, respectively. I couldn't find an exact time when the term Pontic Mountains or Pontic Alps began to be used, but I would be willing to bet it was around the same time as Pontic began to be used to describe the Black Sea area as a whole, which I think is right around the mid-1500s AD, is when that began to kind of become the popular term for the region, at least in English. And this comes from the Latin Ponticus, which is from the Greek Pontikos or Pontos, which is a variant form or a variant from the Pyrrhup Pint, and that's Proto-Indo-European, which meant to tread or to go. Now, this was not the original Greek name for the sea, though. We'll dive more into that history later. I don't know if it'll be this season or next, but we're not going to go into the Black Sea etymology just yet. Now, of course, Alps is a reference to the European mountain range, which, again, we're going to go into that when we talk about the Alps specifically. But it's just like saying these are the Alps of the Pontus. Next up, we have the Talysh or Talysh Mountains. Now, these are mostly located in Azerbaijan or modern-day Azerbaijan, though there are some in kind of the far northwest of Iran as well. Now, these kind of, they are, I'm trying to think, so they kind of extend southeast from a lowland in Azerbaijan. So it's kind of a, there's a little bit of a break between the Anti-Caucasus Mountains, and then you have this lowland zone where, you know, it's much more hospitable, I guess, most of the time compared to the Talysh Mountains. But after you get to that lowland zone, you do get to kind of the Talysh Mountains. Now, the name on this is not known. We know that the name comes from the Talysh people, the people living there, or the, you know, at least the, I guess, the oldest group living there, at least from what we can tell, are the Talyshis. Now, they've been in the area for quite a while. I think since at least they've been referred to that since like the 920s AD, where the Arabs referred to them as Al-Taylasan or Lashan. Now, they are an Iranian people. They are, you know, related to the ancient Persians in some way. I think they themselves believe they're descended from the Quduci, which were one of the Iranian tribes that made up the old Persian Achaemenid Empire. And there is some evidence for that. There's certainly not enough to discount it out of hand. In fact, most of the evidence I think we have kind of backs up their claim. But there are, of course, no definitive proof on that. But the people kind of gave their name to that mountain range. Now, it did have different names, which could also be tied to older groups at earlier periods, but it seems like the names of the mountain has kind of followed the primary ethnic identity of the people living in the region. But again, they're not the only people of that ethnic identity living in the region. They're just the ones that have been there the longest, I guess you would say. Now, these mountains are kind of, they make a very natural geographic border between the Caucasus region and Iran. And that's not just modern Iran. That's like, you know, there's a lot of cultural differences between the two regions, even though they're very close. And that's something that you'll see happen a lot with mountains. They do make excellent natural barriers. And it does kind of slow the diffusion of ideas and technology if there is, you know, popular resistance to it or an idea that, you know, our ways are better. That can kind of serve as a really good buffer point. Now, these mountains are also part of the reason that the Kalish people have been semi-independent from a lot of the more powerful centralized governments. When they're loyal, you know, it's not a problem. But when they are in a more leave-us-alone mood, they can, you know, hold out. They can kind of stay out of people's way, and, you know, going to them is a huge pain in the butt, you know, historically speaking. But there are periods where they are more receptive to the central government, and there are times where they just kind of want to maintain and do their own thing. But that's all, of course, stuff that comes up later. Like the Caucasus, you will see there are historic periods where, you know, a number of wild animals that you don't expect to be in the region used to live. Up to very recently, the Caspian tiger, I think they had more in these mountain ranges even than the Caucasus Mountains, which, of course, the Caspian tiger went extinct, I think, in the 60s or 70s. So not all that long ago. But anyway, one of their main ranges was this kind of Talysh Mountains border region. Next up, we have the Alborz Mountains in what is mostly modern-day Iran, though there is a tiny sliver in modern-day Azerbaijan, much like the Talysh Mountains. However, these mountains are distinct. Their stone is a little bit different. And of course, they have a different run. These are almost curl entirely around the southern portion of the Caspian Sea. But it has a different set of, plant life and things like that because of the I think the environment. Though there is a lot of overlap in animals. There's a lot of the same ibexes. Caspian tigers lived in the area. You have a whole bunch of different species where there is, again, overlap. Though the stone and plant life is a little bit different. The modern city of Tehran is kind of nestled kind of right up close to the kind of the center part of the Alborz Mountains. And the modern city of Tabriz kind of sits halfway between the Alborz and the northwestish portion of the Zagros Mountains. And of course, it's very close also to the Talysh Mountains. Those are kind of to their north. So it's kind of boxed in on three sides, or near enough to it. Now, the name of the Alborz Mountains is a little bit more known, or at least there's generally not as many theories. In fact, they're all kind of focused on the name coming from the Avesta, which is like the holy book of the Zoroastrian religion. It's derived from the term Harabarazati, and I know I butchered that. Sorry to any Zoroastrians listening. But this is kind of like, this is the major mythical mountain. It's like the Olympus of the Zoroastrian tradition and faith. But this is written in Proto-Iranian. It was, again, Harabarazati, Harabarazati is another abbreviation for it. It essentially meant like high mountain rampart or high mountain guard, something along those lines. It's believed to have come from something along the lines of the Proto-Iranian, not Proto-Persian, kind of like the precursor, like one of the early precursors to modern Persian, something like Byzant, or along those lines. But it could also have meant some type of protection. But anyway, eventually, as time came on, in Middle Persian, Harabarazati, or Zati, became Harborz. They just shortened it to just Harbours. And then in modern Persian, it further evolved into Alboros, which is also closely related to Elbrus, which is the highest peak of the Caucasus. Kind of showing, again, one of the theories connecting the name of the Caucasus with Proto-Indo-European. Maybe the names have a similar origin. Or at least the name for the highest peak in the Caucasus, which is Elbrus. Obviously, shining white does not have anything to do with high mountain protector or something along those lines. These mountains are going to be an excellent source of oak and beech wood. They also have a lot of olive trees kind of in the western portion of the Alborz Mountains, which is going to be a very important trade good, not to mention one of the more, heavily exploited resources as the area begins to develop more sophisticated or more complicated, at the very least, societies. And of course, this region will, feel some influence from the Mesopotamian cities, though not nearly as much as the area further to the kind of east and south in the Zagros Mountains, which we're going to go ahead and move on to now. Now, kind of to the extreme northwest of the Zagros, which we've already technically covered, I think, those parts of the Zagros. They kind of butt up to the Taurus Mountains in southern Anatolia. This portion of the range is just to the south of Lake Van in modern-day Turkey. And it kind of stretches all along what is now the border of Turkey, Iraq, and Iran. And then they kind of flow down pretty much almost the entirety of the Iraq-Iran border, except for that one little section where the mountains kind of curve inland. And these kind of curve all the way to kind of the where the Iranian coast kind of curves again to I think Hormuz is, where that little portion of the Arabian Peninsula kind of like bites almost into it, or it looks like it's going to bite. It obviously doesn't reach there directly. But so very long mountain range for these Zagros. I think they run around, 1,600 kilometers, which is just short of 1,000 miles. Not too wide in comparison. I think they're only around 250 kilometers wide, which is like 160 miles. But very long mountain range. And that does inhibit, of course, moving directly, through Iran into Iraq and vice versa. So you have to enter at certain points, follow through, and, go through like these little passes and valleys. And then maybe, depending on where you're going, come out at a different place. So that does make travel difficult. But it is a very important route, so trade does flow through there. But control of this trade routes, these are going to be a very big issue going forward, as I'm sure you have already guessed and understand from just a basic understanding of modern history. Now, the name of the Zagros is not very well known. In the Sumerian writings, this is known. These mountains are known as Kor or Kur, which is, these were mythical mountains, but, eventually the Sumerians kind of said, yes, those are the mountains in the myth. Again, we're not sure of the modern Zagros name. There are some people who think it is related to Avestan, like the Alborz Mountains. They think it is something along the lines as it descended from the Avestan Esprok or Espros. Or it could have been a derivative of an Avestan word Zagur or Zagur or Zagar, which would have meant like big mountain, which, you know, that one's pretty straightforward. But there are people who think that it was the name of one of the Indo-European tribes living in the area known as Sargartians. And these would have been related to, you know, probably would have been related to at least linguistically, if not ethnically, a lot of the other Indo-Iranian peoples. Because there were several Indo-Iranian groups moving through the Zagros in the both the early historic period and even the prehistoric period. Now, in older versions of the Persian language and in early Persian writings, the mountains are called the Patak. That's P-A-T-A-Q. And that name is actually still used for a portion of a different mountain range. The Persians, I think, began to use Zagros at kind of the kind of towards the end of I think it's the 1700s AD, and this was when a lot of the European authors were, or you know, writers and travelers were really beginning to take a bigger interest in the region for a number of reasons, but also mainly, you know, a lot of it had to do with the Greek classics, the Greek and Roman classics. The Greeks use Zagros, and it kind of became, you know, something that the dynasty at the time began to use internationally. Though I don't know that they really considered all of those ranges as really one at that time. I think there was a very local kind of flavor to the naming convention. You know, you would defer to whichever group lived in a specific range or part of the mountain range. So there were a lot of local names. They just kind of gave the overall term, gave into the, like, the Greek form of the overall term. But obviously there were a lot of Iranian peoples who had their own section of the mountain that they considered theirs, that portion or that, you know, segment is still in use to some extent. So the Iranians, at least at the period we're talking about, they didn't really have a name for the range as a whole. They kind of deferred to local customs and administrations. But there are, of course, I think some traditionalists, and I mean like hardcore traditionalists, not like the theocratic government today. But I think there's a growing number of, and I don't know if it's a huge portion of the population, but there is more of an interest in ancient Persian tradition and customs. And there is, I think, in some circles, kind of an idea that maybe they should rework the name. But I don't think that that's very popular. At least as far as I know. But that's just some stuff I've read online. That could be completely overblown. It could be, you know, weirdos on the internet that I'm just stumbling upon looking for etymology information. And they could be, you know, a much smaller group than my understanding would leave us to believe. So take that with a grain of salt. But the Zagros Mountains are really, like, reading about them recently really makes me want to see them. I doubt I'll ever be able to go, but it would be fun to visit a few places in there. They look very interesting. Now, much like the Alborz and the Talysh Mountains, it has their own kind of variety of animals and plants. I didn't read anything about the Caspian lion being found in the area. I'm sure there were maybe one or two, but there were a lot of mountain lions. This is one of the big areas where you would see the Asian lion would be found in that range. Fairly late in history, from my understanding. But this is kind of a good area to move, you know, to move through. If you wanted to bypass having to go through Mesopotamia,
You could just stay in the mountains and kind of move on the outskirts of Mesopotamia if there was some reason you didn't want to go there. And I think that there are periods where that might be something people want to do. And we'll go into that, of course, much later. Trying to think if there was anything else. These are formed where the Arabian plate is hitting the Eurasian plate. All these mountains, as far as I know, still have some seismic activity, the ones we've been talking about today. However, with the possible exception of the Caspian, I don't know that they have much seismic activity these days. But I think the Zagros Mountains by far have the most seismic activity going on in them. There are, you know, periods where earthquakes and disasters following earthquakes happen that, you know, will be engines of change and chaos and all that kind of stuff, which, again, we'll go into all that kind of stuff later. The Zagros Mountains are also home to two of the more important water features, I guess, for lack of a better term, that we'll be talking about, you know, when we discuss these regions. One of these is Lake Urmia. Now, this is a saltwater lake, and it's kind of in the Iran's extreme northwest. It's not far from Tabriz, the city I discussed that's kind of like bound by those different mountain ranges on three sides. But this is to the west of Tabriz, in the kind of like where there's a divot in the Zagros Mountains. And if you look at a map in Iran, it's like, it's the only, like, really big lake in Iran that you would see if you just glanced at a map, as far as I'm aware of. Now, this is a saltwater lake. It does not have an outflow to the sea. All the water collected from the various streams and rivers from the area and any kind of rain that gets through, not that there's much, at least, you know, in the grand scheme of things, all of that kind of gets collected in Urmia. And then, it evaporates over time. Now, I think this lake has begun to shrunk recently. It's actually shrunk a lot. I think it's 10% of its former size since 1998. Now, part of this is because of there's been a very long-running drought in Iran, but they've also been damming local rivers that kind of feed into it, and they're pumping out groundwater from the surrounding area. And part of that, again, is due to, you know, drought. They need the water. But I do think that in the last couple of years, at least a couple of times, that, you know, it did begin to see a little bit more precipitation in the region. So hopefully it'll begin to get back up a little bit closer to its former size. Now, the origin of the name is one of those things that's also debated. Some people think that it is Urartian or Urartian, and the Urartu are like an Iron Age people that kind of lived in the Armenian Highlands. There's several, you know, they were around Lake Van as well. Lake Sivan is another, which is in, I think, modern day, I want to say it's in modern day Armenia as well. But it may also have been modern-day Azerbaijan. I'd have to check the map again. But they had a number of settlements and sites all throughout these mountain ranges that we've been talking about. So it's very possible the name came from them. Some people believe it's Indo-Iranian, which it would have come something like from the word Urmi or Urmaya, which would be like wavy. But then there's also another theory that it came from like one of the Assyrian Chaldean languages, which it would have just been Urmia, which would be the city Ur of water, Mia. So make of that what you will. It's debated. I think the second two are more likely, but that's just me kind of breaking it down etymologically. I haven't really dived into, you know, the Urartian language too much just yet. So maybe there's a good explanation there. Also, you know, I haven't read the historical sources, so I don't know, you know, what it might have been referred to at earlier periods. There's always a chance that there's some passing mention to some lake that no one knows exactly where it is, and it could be described by one of those. So I'm gonna hold off on a bigger judgment until I get more information. And interestingly enough, the first signs of a really large-scale settlement in the region begins right at the start of this season's date, right around 6000 BC. Maybe a little bit earlier, maybe a little bit later. But, you know, this area has been occupied by hominids for a very long time, at least passing through it, Neanderthals including, you know, included in that, as well as early Homo sapiens. But it is interesting that it's at this point that you really begin to see signs of life, or at least human habitation, around this Great Salt Lake right this period of time. So just make of that what you will as well. Now, the next thing we need to move on to is the other big feature of the Zagros Mountains, and this is the Karun River. Now, this is fed by a number of smaller rivers and streams, kind of all coming down from various parts of the Zagros Mountains, and then today this river runs to the south and then a little bit to the west, and it feeds into the Sha'at al-Arab, which is the combination of the Tigris and the Euphrates. It meets them just to the northwest of the city of Abadan. Now, in the past, this had a different name. It was called Pasit Tigris. Essentially, it meant Little Tigris. And then that's what you'll see a lot of early Arab and Persian geographers call it. They'll also name it the Jail, which is the Arabic for, like, Little Tigris. But eventually, the name Karun becomes more popular for whatever reason. I'm not sure if that was kind of like a kind of the Persians deciding to rename the river, you know, or give it a different naming convention than what the Arabs had given it. There was a period of time after the Islamic conquest where the Persians were reestablishing their own political independence, if not, you know, reestablishing their old religious traditions. That's a guess on my part. That's something I'm going to have to look into later. But the name Karun is actually, is a corruption of the name Hurong, which is the old name for the Karun River, which, again, in fact, the Kurong name is still used by one of the major tributary rivers of the Karun. I'm not sure why Karun replaced the Pasit Tigris. Maybe it was something politically related. Maybe it was a shift in the primary tongue of the region. I don't know. I could not find a solid answer. That's something I'm going to also have to research. But these are the big water features that are going to take, you know, or at least where a lot of human activity that we're going to be covering in the next couple of episodes are taking place. Now, there are two other big water sources that we're going to be talking about for the next couple episodes. And these are in the Caucasus/Anti-Caucasus/Alborz Mountains. Sorry, not the Alborz, the Talysh Mountains. These are the Kura and the Aras rivers. Now, the Kura gets rainfall and water flowing down from melting ice from the caucuses and the anti-caucuses, and the Arras gets water coming from the anti-caucuses and the Talysh Mountains. And the Arras eventually does merge into the Kura, and these all kind of flow into the Caspian Sea. All of these rivers and the little tributaries are very important for the various communities all throughout the Caucasus region, not just for, historically, but also in the modern day. Azerbaijan, Armenia, Turkey, Georgia, all are very, very reliant on rivers, rivers and streams coming down from the, coming down from the mountains. Now, the Kura River comes from the Mingrelian language, which is one of the Kartvelian languages, which are the languages spoken in Georgia, or mostly in Georgia. There are other places where they're spoken. Georgian is Kartvelian as well, but the Mingrelian is Kur, means water or river. And it's very interesting to me that, Kur for these languages is water, whereas Kur in the Sumerian languages is mountain. So, kind of opposites in that way. I think the Georgian name is, and I'm going to butcher this because I cannot speak any kind of Kartvelian. It's hard to read for me, but it's Mutkvari or Mutkuari. So, you can see there's a little bit of overlap there. That's what they would call the river, specifically in Georgia. In fact, I think there is a, where the river first starts to form, is called the Makarvi, pretty much by everyone. But once you get a little bit past Tbilisi, it becomes the Kura River. essentially, like all of the other languages, share a similar name for it. It's Kur in Azerbaijani. In Persian, it's Kor. Armenian, it's Kur. And in Turkish, it's Kur. And I think the Greeks called it Kyros or Kuris, but I'm not sure if that's exactly the pronunciation. Don't quote me on that one. I didn't check too hard on that pronunciation. Whereas the Aras River is historically known as the Araxes. You'll see that talked about in the Greek sources. Now, the name for that in the Armenian tradition is that it's named after Arast. And he was a great-grandson of, like, the Armenian people's, like, primogenitor. I think his name was Haik. Is what his name was, and Arast was one of his descendants, like one of his very important descendants. I think Strabo talks about how at some point the Araxes didn't actually have an outflow to the Caspian Sea, but it was kind of spread out into like a kind of a marshy plain, and eventually in a lake as well. But eventually they kind of dug a trench to allow it to meet and flow into the Kura River. Now, I don't know if there's ever been any archaeological studies of that done, but it would be interesting, form of like water management if they did drain that area and turn it into, pasture or farmland. Arabic and Persian Turkish all call it the Aras. The Arabic is the Al Aras. So they also use that local naming tradition. So it's a very old name for those rivers. But they're going to be, of course, important going forward, as I'm sure you have guessed. I keep having to put stuff off, but. I do feel like it's important to kind of learn this stuff, just so you have a general idea of the geography. I think that's important to know. Now, the Aras River is actually one of the borders, primary borders for Azerbaijan and Iran. In fact, if you look on the Wikipedia page for the Aras River, you can see someone's taken a picture from the Iranian side looking down at the river, and you can kind of see, well, this side's our Azerbaijan, and Iran's on the left side. So it's a very nice shot. Whoever did a really good job. So, wow, we're a little over 45 minutes. Okay, well, I think those are the high points for the etymology of the stuff I wanted to talk about. We're going to go into the people next week. I'd like to thank you guys for joining me. Thank you for letting me get my sea legs back, as it were, kind of get back into the swing of things. I hope you all will enjoy the longer episode, even if it's not strictly history. But, you know, I feel like, again, etymology, how names change is always interesting. And I wanted to kind of give you an idea of what the people in the areas are going to be working with. But yeah, so we'll be back next Monday. And we should have no interruption of episodes for the Christmas season coming up. Christmas is on a Wednesday this year. So I will have my episodes recorded. There might be a slight delay for the week of New Year's. I'm not sure yet. I'm gonna bring all my stuff to record. You know, depending on what's going on, that might be a little delayed that week of the 30th. But if so, it won't be more than a couple of days. But yeah, I plan to have an episode out every other Monday for sure this month. So the 2nd, the 9th, the 16th, 23rd, and the 30th. So, thank you all for joining me. If you have any questions, comments, constructive criticism, please feel free to drop me an email at waradrevpod@gmail.com. You can contact me via direct message on X and or Twitter, whatever you want to call it. You can also comment on the YouTube videos. And, you know, I am streaming live on YouTube. I did stream a little bit last week when I returned from my trip. Only a couple of days, because then I left again to go see family for Thanksgiving. But I plan on streaming every day this week, including the weekend. So if you want to drop by, say hi there, feel free. Please like, subscribe, rate on whatever platform you're listening on. It really helps the channel grow. I know the algorithm is going to hate me because I took a couple of weeks off. We're close to 180 on YouTube. We were at 181 at one point, but I lost a couple during the hiatus. So, disappointing, but it's to be expected. People want content all the time. So, I hope you enjoy the content. But thank you all for joining me. I appreciate the support. I'll see everyone next time. Have a good Monday. Have a good week. Whenever you're listening to this, I appreciate you all. Peace.